What is the highest of all practical goods? Asked Aristotle at the beginning of the Nicomachean Ethics. Well, he went on, so far as the name goes, there is pretty general agreement. It is happiness. Welcome to the After Dinner Scholar, Wyoming Catholic College's weekly podcast about the great books and the liberal arts. I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tonkowicz. After identifying happiness as the highest of all practical goods, something on which most people agree, Aristotle continued, but when it comes to saying in what happiness consists, opinions differ, to say the least. As the Ray Conniff singer sang back in 1966, happiness is different things to different people. And within our culture, most people would answer with a hearty amen. But is happiness simply different things to different people? Or are there common threads? Can we explore happiness and human nature to learn what happiness is apart from everyone's subjective opinion? For Aristotle, and with him the Western tradition until just recently, the answer is yes. We can discover what happiness is, a quest he took up in the Nicomachean Ethics. Dr. Michael Bolin has been teaching Aristotle's ethics to juniors, and he is our guest this week on the After Dinner Scholar. Dr. Bolin, while Aristotle's ethics addresses happiness, he begins by asking about the good. What is the good, and why does he begin there?
Well, he defines the good in the opening sentence. It's quite famous as that which all desire. And the idea there is not that our will sort of makes things good by desiring them, but the other way around, that our wills are unavoidably, ineluctably drawn to the good, and it's simply not possible to desire a thing that is evil just in as much as it is evil, something entirely evil. We might want the worst things, but there's always some fragment of good there that our will is drawn to. And that's sort of the idea. The good is the natural object of the will, and it's the only thing that we can be drawn to, at least in some respect. And why he begins there, the idea, the book is about ethics, of course, how we ought to act. And if it is true, as he takes it to be, that our actions are always in some way, at least in some respect, directed towards the good, because that's the only thing we can desire, then some knowledge of what the good is inevitably going to guide our behavior. And the only question will be, how do we make sure that we're desiring what is good simply, what is good wholly, and not just some fragment of good and what is otherwise evil? But because we have to be drawn to the good somehow, that's going to be the principle governing our actions.
Now, he says that everybody wants to be happy, and he is all for happiness. How does that settle with our students? Is that what life is all about, being happy?
Well, there's a couple things to say to that. On the face of it, it often strikes people, including our students, as odd to say that all our actions are ordered to happiness, because it sounds kind of egocentric or self-centered, you know, do whatever floats your boat kind of thing. But the first thing to say there is that happiness, like good, doesn't just mean whatever pleases us or whatever we happen to desire in the moment. Aristotle, by happiness, means the human good. He comes to his notion of happiness by talking about what it means to be a good flute player or a good carpenter or human professions. And everyone knows that a good flute player is one who plays the flute well. There's no debate about that, right? That's what it means. What we don't usually think about is, what does it mean to be human well? And like with the flute players, the skill of playing the flute possessed well, for human beings, happiness is their good. It's being human well, which means something like doing the activity that is characteristic of human beings with excellence. What's characteristic of human beings? Well, that's acting as rational animals in accord with our reason. So we do have passions. We do want to fulfill them. We might think of that as being involved in happiness. But what's distinctively human is that our passions can be governed by reason. And it's doing that well which is essential to happiness for Aristotle. So it's not just arbitrary. It's not just hedonism, gratifying yourself, but governing your emotions, your passions, your life with your rationality. So that's the first thing. The other, I guess I would add, is that happiness is also not really self-centered in this respect, that human beings are also by nature social. There's something unnatural about isolating oneself. And John Donne famously says, no man is an island entire of himself. And what that implies is that the human good, happiness, human flourishing is going to imply something not just about ourselves, but about our relationship to others. And so that Aristotle makes happiness the principle of his ethics doesn't make it self-centered, because human beings are sort of intrinsically directed outwards. And so fulfilling our good is going to mean as well acting in a certain way in relation to others, acting justly, generously, and so forth. And so it won't even be self-centered.
Well, in what I suspect comes as a surprise, Aristotle argues that we study the highest good through politics. How is that the case? And I suppose we need to begin by asking what Aristotle means by politics.
Yes, that is one of the stranger points in Nicomachean Ethics to me, personally. He begins early on, as you say, by saying that sort of political science is the highest science, highest practical science, because it directs all aspects of our lives. It has an actually vaguely totalitarian vibe, the way Aristotle talks about politics and Nicomachean Ethics, as though the statesman is the one who commands every virtue and forbids every vice and governs every aspect of our lives, and that tends to rub us the wrong way. But I think that what's going on there is more that he's describing some kind of theoretical ideal without a consideration of whether or not it can be implemented. I think in real life you couldn't have the perfect legislator. Well, I mean, I guess that would be God, but no human being is going to be the perfect legislator who could arrange society for the best. There's because of human weakness in the first place, but second of all, because human beings rebel against being told, having a law that tells you what color socks to wear or something like that. Maybe rightly so. It's more of a theoretical point. That is, if the ultimate end of all human beings is happiness, then the right and all-encompassing view of happiness would have implications for every aspect of our lives. But that, say, one human being, or the statesman or a politician, could actually direct that himself is not, I think, a practical reality. But there are some signs that I don't think Aristotle means it that way. That's maybe more clear in his book Politics, but also when he talks about the legislator throughout the book Nicomachean Ethics, he always talks as though the natural assumption is that the laws are always good and just. And like all of us in practice, he's aware that's not really true. And so the fact that he speaks that way is another sign that this isn't a sort of a practical treatise so much as a question of the goal of law or the goal of politics, which would be to make us virtuous. But I think we shouldn't understand it with that kind of totalitarian sense that it feels like at first.
But certainly in the sense of man as a political animal.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Getting back to happiness, he connects happiness to virtue, to pleasure, and to citizenship. Could you comment on those?
Sure. He actually defines virtue as that excellence of human activity that will be conducive to or constitutive of happiness. So again, with his previous analogy, the excellence of the carpenter, the virtue of the carpenter is what makes him do carpentry well. Virtue in general for human beings is what makes us be human, be rational beings well. And so that sort of is defined as that characteristic of our being that orders us to be happy, makes us be happy well. And then he goes on to talk about how the things we think of as virtues, temperance, generosity, are particular instances of that. But most immediately, virtue is just defined as a characteristic of our activity that orders us to happiness. So that would be the connection there. Pleasure, he takes pleasure to be a kind of crown of excellent activity. So if you are a generous person for Aristotle, if you have the virtue of generosity, it's not simply that you will perform generous acts, you'll give to the needy and so forth. That's not enough to be virtuous. You have to actually enjoy doing that, be so disposed that you take pleasure in it. So if you donate to charity or whatever, and you do that because you're concerned about your social image and it really kind of eats you up inside, you'd rather not, that's not generosity, even if externally the act might look the same. Mm-hmm. And so pleasure has this sort of essential connection to virtue. To have the virtue is not just enough Yeah, to do the external act. You have to do it out of a state that makes you feel good about doing it. You desire to do it. And that you would feel bad if you didn't do it. So it's not some kind of hedonistic sense of pleasure where, you know, bodily pleasure is the good or something like that. But a more, usually when he's talking about pleasure, it's a more mental or intellectual thing. That sense of doing good, or the joy in doing what is noble that goes with doing virtuous actions.
Well, so it's contrary to Kant, who says you do the right thing because you do the right thing, and it doesn't matter how you feel about it, right?
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. Kant has this notion of duty where the right thing to do could be completely independent, as it were, of its relationship to the human happiness. If giving to charity is the right thing, it doesn't matter how you feel about it or something like that. And Aristotle's saying, no, well, how you feel about it is very essential to figuring out, determining whether you have the virtue of generosity or not. It's an essential part of it. So it's kind of a paradox for Aristotle that to acquire the habit of virtue, you have to do the action many times, although initially you won't have the right state. So if you're a child being told to do the dishes, you're not going to like it at first. But, and that's a sign you don't have a virtue, you're missing a virtue there, right? But you do it enough, eventually you realize it's not so bad, and you know, you start to acquire the habit where it's, this is actually an okay thing to be doing, right? So, yeah, there's much more, it's not just about the act itself, but about the internal state of the acting agent. And I think that's much clearer in Aristotle, and maybe even, as you say, missing in Kant.
Mm-hmm. Well, and certainly there in the scriptures. The idea that we follow the law, we obey Christ out of love for him, and what else? I think it's
right. And that's, you see that in the Christian. That's right, in the Christian tradition. Right. It's better to obey out of fear than to not obey, but it's much, much better to obey out of love. Mm-hmm. Right. And that, so the root of the kernel of that, I think, you do find in Nicomachean Ethics.
He says that happiness demands not only complete goodness but a complete life. What does he mean by that? And how then do we acquire happiness? What is a complete life?
There's a kind of paradox or difficulty he tries to deal with, which is, how do you determine if someone is happy? You know, someone may be in the prime of life and have what they need and be a good person, and they may eventually come to a wretched end. And the question is, was it right at that time in the past when they seemed happy to say they were happy? Or do you have to wait until the person is dead to, so you feel safe making a judgment? He kind of tries to strike a middle ground. He wants to say, it's true, you can't, happiness isn't so passing that you can be happy for an instant. It's something fuller than that. Sometimes some scholars prefer to translate that term actually as human flourishing, which has a more the sense of a fullness of human life, perhaps, than happiness does. So he has this idea that we think of happiness as our good. That is the thing we seek. We can't not seek it. It's got to be something that has stability and permanence. And so it takes place over time. It's a kind of activity for him. And that's one of the things that distinguishes it maybe from just our common parlance. We think of happiness as like an emotion or a state of euphoria or something. But for Aristotle, it is the activity of living well, human flourishing. So it necessarily takes place over time. So complete life, I think, would be anything that exemplifies that. I don't think he ultimately wants to say it has to be the entirety of your life in some sort of mathematically complete sense, like if you had 2 months when you were unhappy, then your whole life is unhappy. But it has to be the sort of thing we could look at this person, the broad scope of their life, and say he lived well, right? He, you know, like all of us, maybe there was suffering at times, but the trend of it, so to speak, is living well. So I think it's a complete in the sense of, by and large, the majority. There was a stability to his state of character. It's also related to that notion of virtue as a habit. It's not just about an individual act, but if you really have the habits of virtue, they're ingrained in you. They're not easy to lose, and so you will see the manifestation playing out over time. You don't have virtue for 2 minutes and then have vice. It doesn't fluctuate so quickly. It's more stable than that.
How do the students overall receive the book?
It's generally pretty well liked. A number of times I've gotten comments from students that this is their favorite class, and much as I would like to think that's about me, I think it's more about Aristotle's text. It can be difficult to get into at first. It's odd, not the way they're used to thinking about virtue and happiness, but I've generally found it to be pretty well received, and sometimes people tell me it's, in after time, when they've had time to think about and just had time to sink in that they find it makes a big difference in their lives.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, states the Declaration of Independence, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Of course, they did not define what they meant by happiness. Perhaps they felt there was no need, though if there was need in the 4th century BC when Aristotle wrote, there was probably need in the 1770s. In today's moral chaos, the need is only that much greater. Aristotle is not the final word on happiness, but his challenging ethics lays out many of the questions and some of the answers we need today. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.